Light beer, dark money. Agree on something. Politics, culture, and the intersection of faith, freedom, and free enterprise. And now, live from the Star Worldwide Network studios, here are your hosts, Light Beer, Chris Clements, and Dark Money, Sean Noble.
Welcome back to another episode of Light Beer, Dark Money. I'm Sean Noble.
I am Chris Clements.
How are you? I always sound over the top when I start.
Well, that's because, not how I talk. Because you have that voice.
Yeah, right.
You have a voice made for radio.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. That's, as we all know, my broadcasting degree did not get me on TV. Yeah. Speaking of on TV, Carrie Lake's our nominee. She spent a lot of time on TV. We have Kathy Arad.
Yes.
From Center for Arizona Policy.
Very special guest. Her second time on Light Beer, Dark Money.
Yeah.
And in our new digs. What do you think?
I'm impressed.
Yeah. We paid a lot for this.
Yeah. It's a lot
in
closer.
In blood and sweat and tears.
Yeah.
That's pretty. And you're still going. So that's great.
You know, we still have people coming on, which is really a blessing.
Yeah. Me being on didn't torpedo the whole deal.
It didn't. No. It actually made people really interested in this idea that, hey, wait, maybe this has legs.
Maybe.
Maybe. We'll
see. So you've been watching politics, obviously, for many, many years. What do you think of the primary results? Anything that was a surprise? And how do things look as we head into the general?
Well, I've said if Republicans can snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, they're on their way to doing it. I've thought that for quite some time. I am concerned. I think it's all a mess right now. I think it's very divided. I think that there's a lack of strategy and wisdom often. And that's going to hurt in the long run. And I've seldom seen it so divided and so much at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then now as we look to the general, what's going to happen were some of the endorsements in the primary that made a difference in the primary, for example, the former president, what's he going to do to get these people elected in the general election?
Right.
So just some of those concerns that it's not, you know, when people start talking about this big red wave or big conservative wave, and I'm like, we'll see.
Right.
We can't take anything for granted right now.
Well, and I think, and this will go right to an issue that is near and dear to your heart. The Dobbs decision clearly has had some impact on what things look like in the fall, or at least the perception is. When the Alito opinion leaked, I kind of felt like, well, I mean, one, we knew it was coming. And two, I figured, if you are a single-issue voter on this issue, then you're voting anyway. I mean, it's not like it's going to increase. Now, that may be the way the Democrats are messaging this. They may increase turnout with younger women than they would otherwise. But why has the pro-life side been so scattershot on this? The thing that I've been the most surprised by is that this has been the battle for 50 years, and it happens. And not only did it happen, we had a 3-month heads up. How in the world, when this actually came down in June, was there not a unified message coming from the pro-life community? I mean, I was baffled.
On the national level, the challenge, information or what I saw, you had a lot of the national pro-life groups working together for Dobbs and the day it came down. No one is leading or coordinating what happens now. And so scattershot's probably a good description. And so on the national level, you've got some that are involved in campaigns, you've got some doing this or that. But as far as the media, the messaging, what's going to work, being caught a little flat-footed on responding, and of course the media is totally in sync.
Mm-hmm.
We've been prepared, and we were laying groundwork, but it's probably gone slower than I would have liked. As far as, like, what do we need to do in Arizona? The misinformation has been very difficult. I mean, the narrative has been set. You know, the idea that a pregnant woman walking down the street is, you know, going to be in danger, or that a woman with an ectopic pregnancy won't be able to get treatment. And you know, I think most of us, when you stop and think, you realize that a woman with an ectopic pregnancy, her life is in danger.
Right.
So there's no pro-life law that is going to stop that woman from getting treatment to remove that ectopic pregnancy. And so that, and even like the media narrative that, oh, the law in Arizona that's been on the books since whether they say 1901 or 1864 or like prehistoric, you know, almost right. kind of thing. And no, the real truth is it was in effect on January 21st, 1973, the day before Roe versus Wade came down. In 1977, it was reaffirmed by the state legislature. So it's really the 1977 law, the 1973 law, take your pick, that has been in, you know, would have been in effect absent the Roe versus Wade decision. Mm-hmm. So Arizona clearly, you know, still up until that time, did not have abortion legal except to save the life of the mother. Is it old language? Yes. Does it need to be updated? Probably. But it still was a rational pro-life law. And that's what, you know, we've tried to say. I think also the lack of accurate information, that people didn't know what Roe versus Wade did.
Right.
And I think we see that over and over again, that Roe versus Wade actually legalized abortion up until the moment of birth. And that, you know, so that education to try to break through all the noise out there and to say, so some of these Democrats that are running, that's their position.
Right.
That you could, you know, we used to say that you could have a woman in one emergency room fighting for the life of her unborn child at full stage 40 weeks, and another woman in the next one having an abortion. And it was legal for if her health was endangered. So, you know, some of that is the lack of messaging, the money difference.
Right.
I mean, the abortion industry is loaded, and we're not.
Yeah.
And so to have that kind of sophisticated media campaign ready to go, that hasn't happened.
Yeah. What, so the, and this is, I think, something that Republican candidates and office holders have been not very good at, and because they've tended to cower. But the position of every Democrat in the House, the U.S. House, is abortion up to birth. They voted on that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that that is, I mean, there's no question that that's an extreme position, because even Pew and Gallup, when you look at this issue, it's somewhere, as far as Americans supporting abortion for any reason up to the time of birth, it's about somewhere between 10 and 13%. It's a very small minority. The vast majority of Americans feel like there should be some restrictions, especially after the second trimester, or all restrictions
really
except for life
like
of the mother.
15 and 20 weeks.
Yeah. And what's fascinating to me is when you hear those that are pro-abortion talking about, you know, this is terrible for women. And, you know, you hear people say, oh, we'll go to Europe because they're such, you know, so much better for women's rights. Most of Europe, I think all of Europe, is pretty much at 15 weeks.
12. There's some countries that have it at 8.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
it's a bad argument.
Yeah,
we're in line with China and North Korea.
Yeah, exactly.
On allowing abortions up until the moment of birth, and so when you start to talk about that, then people. I mean, we've done some of the polling and focus group work. When you start to bring out some of that, then people. Oh, I didn't realize that. No, I don't support that.
Right. Now,
yeah, I think you're right. The Republicans who are being hammered on this issue are not doing a good job of fighting back and pointing out the absolute extreme on the other side in terms of votes that have been taken.
Right.
Which is for infanticide. I've said it on the show before. I think up until birth or even what's being proposed in California, which is after birth,
right.
that decision can be made. I mean, how do you defend something like that?
You can't. Well, and here in Arizona, as you bring it in, you know, a lot of people, well, not a lot. There's the narrative is that Carrie Lake is an extreme, has an extreme position on abortion. Actually, I'm not certain what it is in a nuanced way, but Katie Hobbs running for governor, her position is radical.
Oh, and I've watched Katie Hobbs for years. I've seen her on the floor of the state Senate. I've seen her let loose with you know, a rant about pro-life laws and any kind of restrictions on abortion. That yeah, she's as extremist. I mean, you take Katie Hobbs, Chris Mays, Julie Gunigal. These women that are running for governor, attorney general, Maricopa County attorney, they are as radical and leftist and extremist on abortion as anyone. They don't see, there's no restriction. I mean, whether it's parental consent, whether it's making sure that the woman's health and safety is protected, I mean, they don't, whether the abortion clinics would have any kind of oversight on safety measures, they're against all of that. And then you've got, you know, saying, well, they're not going to enforce the law.
Right, right. Well, and I think that that's a pretty stark choice, and I think that that's where the messaging needs to be, is that this is a choice between a radical agenda versus someone that or an agenda that is that tries to protect the sanctity of life, and there's probably some exceptions needed. Now, one of the things I was thinking about, and it's amazing how, you know, you start thinking through this stuff a little bit more clearly as there's the debate, but I was thinking that if there's, you know, usually I have personally taken the position, outlaw abortion, except in the cases of rape, incest, and life of the mother. And then there have been people have made arguments about what week, that kind of thing. But I realized that, I mean, if you're pregnant as a result of rape or incest, I mean, and you're allowed to have an abortion, you should have that abortion as early as possible. Not wait until, I mean, there shouldn't be a week issue. I mean, meaning weeks of pregnancy. If the only way that has any bearing is if it's an issue on life of the mother, in my mind. I don't know. It just strikes me as, I would think that if you don't want to carry a pregnancy because of rape or incest, then that should be taken care of early on in the process.
Well, the rape and incest issue is the most challenging. It's the most difficult. And, you know, as a woman is certainly, you know, great empathy. I can't imagine or fathom what it would be like as a woman to have been a victim of rape or incest. So you're traumatized already. The problem is that having an abortion on top of that is just another trauma. And so, you know, should the life of the child be determined by how it was conceived? You know, those are very difficult arguments to make in the public square, right, even though those are true. And what gets overlooked and what's not out there in the narrative is the example of somebody like Ryan Bombacher with Radiance Foundation, who was, his mother was a victim and had him, and he is, you know, just an amazing individual. And so you have stories of women who decided to go ahead and proceed with a pregnancy, mm-hmm, place the child for adoption, and those have been wonderful, heartwarming stories. Those stories aren't out there.
Right.
And to encourage a woman that, okay, you know, to stop and think about it. But, you know, you can't go out in the public square and say, oh, yeah, you know, too bad. I mean, it, you know, it's the most difficult issue because the pro-life community is very divided and on that, yeah, issue. And I've said for a long time that we gave politicians a pass on rape and incest exceptions all these years. So I feel like I can't come in now and say, oh, I'm not going to support you, politician running for office, because you support a rape and incest exception. When we never made, maybe some did, but for generally speaking,
right,
the pro-life movement did not make that the litmus test,
right,
on rape and incest, that we would support someone because we know that it only happens 1-2% of the time. But yet, of course, the narrative that's out there is that, oh, this happens a lot.
Right.
And then if you're a victim of rape, you're almost likely to, you're going to get pregnant. And that doesn't happen that way, you know, kind, yeah, of thing. Right. But that gets lost in the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well what really gets lost in the discussion is the fact that this is in the states now, right?
Well,
it's,
and that's,
in the states.
That's where
and
I was
the states
going,
are going to decide that's something going in the middle.
Because we have been fighting for 50 years that this was a states' rights issue.
Absolutely.
The day after the decision came down, all of a sudden you had people talking about a national abortion ban.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Well, yeah, there's an analogy out there that when we had...
Or codifying Roe, you know, at the national level as well.
Which so is you've what got the Democrats wanted to do.
So you've got both sides fighting out, thinking they can do something on the national level. But really, what we've been arguing for the last 50 years is it needs to be in the states.
But yes and no.
That's why I wanted to ask.
It's been argued that way because there's not... Because of the belief that there's not a right to an abortion in the federal constitution.
Right.
So when you say that that's up to the elected representatives, to the people through their elected representatives, that includes the United States Congress and the president. And so the only way to not have this hodgepodge of laws where it's, you know, where California is paying people to fly into California to have an abortion at any stage of pregnancy for right. any reason, is to have a federal law that is, to call it a national abortion ban. So in some ways, you know, I saw one analogy I thought was interesting to some of the civil rights laws. Where when Brown versus Board of Education came down, what, in 1954, if I have my timing right, then it took 10 years until we had the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Right.
So that, you know, sometimes it just takes a while to get to the federal level. So some of these candidates who are saying, oh, well, it's not a federal issue, that's not true, as shown by what you said earlier. the Women's Health Protection Act, or whatever they're calling it, that would codify Roe on the federal level. So ultimately, if we're going to protect life in all 50 states, it's going to have to be a federal issue. But right now, it's a state's issue. It's not going to be a federal issue for quite some time.
Exactly.
You're not going to be able to overcome the filibuster. There's no way.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, look, give it some time to see what states do, and then there's some actual evidence of, okay, these things are working, this isn't working. I mean, it is frustrating to me that we are about the only country in the world that continues to have this debate. Most countries, like we talked about, particularly in Europe, have settled this. And, you know, there's been a consensus, and it's just not a part of the political process as much. I mean, Ireland a few years ago, but I don't know. But
that's a testament to the commitment of the pro-life community. That because I think for certainly a dedicated pro-lifer like myself, one of the the biggest tragedies that have happened is the taking of unborn life, and that unborn children do have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we don't give up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now the recognition is when you have a victory, okay, this is a new beginning. And so I think it's taking a while for people to understand that, oh, we have probably more work ahead of us than we had in the past.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now the real work begins.
Yes, exactly.
I think you who have said that are absolutely correct.
Yeah, I think that, and I guess there were a lot of people who just felt like, oh, the end is, we're done.
Yeah.
Roe v. Wade is overturned.
Now it becomes difficult. But I mean, and that's a great segue because you've been really hard at work for a long time. And this legislative session that we just exited with a very slim majorities in both the House and the Senate here in the great state of Arizona, you guys kick some butt.
Well,
I mean, I'm just going to put in those very, I wasn't going to, you know, put in swear terms, but I mean, I was.
You were going to say it like I would say it?
Well, yeah, because that's what you do. But I was just looking at the list and that you have on your website, and this might have been one of the most consequential legislative sessions that your organization, Center for Arizona Policy, has had in quite some time. I mean, dealing with the issues of life, which we just touched on, parents' rights and family issues, you know, the girls being able to play their sports and not have men play their sports issues. You guys went to the mat on a lot of different issues.
And we're
so congratulations.
Thank you.
For standing, especially for standing up for parents and families when we're going to refer to California a couple times here. I mean, they are absolutely throwing families under the bus.
Well, and I think you see, I don't know that awakening is really the right term, but there's a level of engagement by parents that we have never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's because of COVID and they saw more of what was going on in their child's education, but parents, you know, the sleeping giant has been awoken. And the idea that, you know, your precious little girl who's trying to play softball or soccer or whatever is going to be playing against a biological male, or that you as a parent aren't going to be informed of what's going on in the classroom. You know, parents want to engage, and they've been blocked from being engaged. And so, you know, there has been a re-engagement, and that's all a good thing. And more civic engagement, I think you're going to see it in school board races this year. I think you're going to see some parents take over some school boards. Let's hope so. And that, you know, this has been needed for a long time. But let me just say, having only 31 and 16 is not fun.
You have a singular reputation. I'm sure that you earned it.
Yeah, not so sure. But anyway, we have lawmakers who see these issues and get these issues and who have values, who have concerns, who believe in foundational principles. And so when they have the opportunity, you know, the idea that a 14-year-old could be given gender reassignment surgery. And most people out there think, what? You know, let's at least wait until they're 18. Even if you support, you know, transitioning or however you want to characterize it, well, there are a lot of decisions you can't make till you're 18. And so why would you, you know, we lost on, you know, a ban on puberty blockers and hormone therapy, but at least said no surgery. And that's where, you know, sometimes it's incremental, you know, as well. But that's what a lot of it is based on what's going to be best for children.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because when we had you on last, it was over a year ago.
Yeah.
And this felt like the trans issue felt a little bit more, I don't know. It felt like it was less settled and that there was a lot more pro-trans push out there than there was on, wait a minute, let's protect kids. I think we've seen a big shift in the last year. I think people are starting to wake up to, wait a minute, it is crazy that we have biological males competing in women's sports.
Well, I think that was the big shift.
I think the UPenn swimmer.
Yeah, the UPenn swimmer.
I mean, swimmer that, I mean, we had the track girls from Connecticut that had started losing their track meets when the two males decided to, you know, be female and go against them in Connecticut races. But I think the UPenn swimmer did so much that, and even the idea that, you know, what females were subject to in the locker room.
Right.
With the biological male walking around and that he won the race and they had no chance. And so, yeah. And even.
Well, especially because a year before he was not Lila. He was Will.
Yeah. Well, and you just, had,
you know, he woke up one day and said, hey, I can win more races.
Well, and you had University of Arizona female swimmers, you know, made a statement. I mean, so you had, yeah. You know, some of the women sports athletes were emboldened to speak out in an awareness, we're not going to have women's sports. And even the 50th anniversary of Title IX.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, wait a minute. We worked so hard to get equity in sports for women, and now we're going to erase it?
And now we're going to let men compete in women's sports.
And that's where, you know, people go too far. And even on the parents' rights issue in the legislature, you know, the other side has doubled down. And they're not on the trans issues, on the parents' rights issues. They're just doubling down. And one of my pet peeves lately is, you know, okay, teachers are leaving the teaching field. It's not just about salary, folks.
Yeah.
It's about the trans stuff. It's about being, you know, forced to have to, you know, use pronouns to do all this kind of stuff that's in there when what happened to teaching the basics? And so teachers are leaving because they don't want to be forced to do those things. So it's not just salary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It's a crazy world we live in.
Crazy, crazy, crazy. But you're right about the doubling down. I going back to this governor's race, I think Katie Hobbs, radical on this issue. You know, she opposed everything that you were doing previously. I mean, she's put out statements against what the legislature did this year. I find it baffling that you are running for a statewide office in any state, but particularly a state like Arizona, and you take such a radical position that is so anti-children and anti-family. It makes reason stare. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, but that's the world that she lives in, right? I mean, that's how she sees the world. That's how they see the world. We see the world differently.
Well,
there's truth, there's your truth, and then there's the truth.
Well, and,
right?
And the fact that, you know, when the Alito decision was leaked, her first tweet was F the patriarchy.
Oh, yeah.
Not F.
Oh, yeah.
And she put it out there. And yeah. I'm like, you are a statewide office holder running for governor, and you tweet F the patriarchy? It's just crazy.
Yeah. Where do you see this all going? Like, what do you see as the big priorities next year after we get through this election, and depending on who we have as governor, secretary of state, and everything else,
Do
you think it accelerates? Do you think it's more heated? Do you think it calms down?
No, I don't think it calms down yet. I think we've got more work to do on protecting parental rights and advancing parental rights. I think there's more work to do on that. I still think we're going to get a lot more litigation on the abortion issue. Mm-hmm. And, of course, right now as we talk, we're waiting for the Pima County judge to decide about the 1973 injunction that barred enforcement of the previous abortion law in Pima County and by the Attorney General. You know, she should just be lifting the injunction. That should be a no-brainer, but we'll see what she does. The 15-week abortion ban in Arizona is scheduled to take effect September 24th. So whether, you know, she's supposed to rule by then, but I still think we're going to get state constitutional challenges. You know, there's, Chris Mays, candidate for Attorney General on the Democrat side, you know, keeps saying there's a broad right to privacy in the state constitution that protects abortion rights. Well, no, it's never been applied in that context. And it's really a search and seizure issue. And, you know, I think we can win on that one, but I think they're going to try it, and they're going to try to get an injunction to at least allow abortion to continue until the court cases would resolve. So I still think we're in you know, we're going to have a couple of years of litigation on abortion on state constitutional grounds and whatever else they can dream up. So that may block the legislature from doing very much. We're in an interesting political stage right now. Is the state legislature going to be more strongly conservative, or are we going to be more like a 31-16? What are the divisions in the Republican Party going to lead to? Are we going to have a united Republican Party trying to elect all the Republicans on the ballot, or only or some that who would rather just keep it closer to 31-16 so the so-called crazies or conservatives would not be able to do more? So I think, you know, it's just going to be a while. But I think with all of it, as we see what's in the future, I just continue to see we need to do more on recruiting candidates for public office. Mm-hmm. And that there's a great need to recruit people who, and a lot of times I think people that are in that half stage of life, you know, they've had their careers or they've raised their children or whatever. I think of a Nancy Bartow and a Steve Yarbrough always, or, you know, that, okay, now's your time to serve and run for office. But we need to have, you know, I hesitate to say better candidates, but that's what we need.
We do need better candidates.
And so we need,
no question.
and so I think that will help. I think that will help as far as on communication, on the narratives and all of that, that we just need to do a lot more in recruiting candidates.
Yeah, well, we've been saying that on the show for a long time.
Yeah.
And training candidates. I mean, if you want to run, you need to make sure that you know how to win.
And not having, I'm not a fan of all these contested primaries.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, so I am very heartened by the number of activist parents who are running for the school board across the state right now. And I think that that's a pretty good training ground for future legislators. Because if you can get involved in the school board level, dealing with all those issues, that prepares you for what you'd face at the legislature, probably as well as anything.
Yeah.
Well, and that's been the Democrats' playbook for quite some time, that how many Democrats that are state legislators were even serving school boards at the same time, but that's certainly where they started. So Center for Arizona Policy Action, this will be the first year that we're going to spend some money on school board races. We're going to engage from an independent expenditure in two or three districts and really try to help some of those candidates get elected. We're going to do we're going to do more endorsements on school board races. And for too long, we've just kind of left that.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, as strong as we support educational freedom and school choice and ESAs and everything, we're still going to have a lot of kids in the public schools. And for too long, we've ignored it.
Yeah. Well, and if other states, what's happening in other states is any guide, it's probably a good investment. I mean, in Florida, you had a whole bunch of solid conservative people get elected to school board in this last primary election.
It was the big coup of DeSantis.
Yeah.
He was able to run 20 of 30 endorsed candidates or something had?
Yeah.
So. That was the big story of that election last week or 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It was the school board piece.
Yeah.
If we can do the same thing here, it would send a shockwave all across the state. So it's good that you guys are getting involved in that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's Kathy. She's always on the cutting edge.
Well, I mean, I go back to that list that I just referenced. And if you go on their website, you'll see all the success. I don't think there's another group that I can recall, you know, maybe the Free Enterprise Club on economic issues, but really the breadth of issues that you all tackle on a year-to-year basis and move the ball forward. I don't see any other group in the country that does what you do on the state level. I just don't.
Well, thank
and
you.
I'm involved in a lot of conservative groups all across the country. I just don't see it.
I do have colleagues that are very active in a number of other states that are doing good work. But
we're
thankful. We feel like God's been good to us, but we've had a good team and all that. But there's a lot of work to be done, and we are, you know. What people often, I think, overlook, it takes a lot of work to get a bill passed, but then to protect that legislation, to get it implemented, right. It's almost like the easiest part. It's not the easiest part, but it's, you know, it's another beginning after you get a bill passed. And, you know, when they all go into effect on September 24th this year, we'll see what happens. And, of course, right now we're fighting the referral of the Empowerment Scholarship Account, universal vouchers, basically, the referral by the public school people to the ballot. We're fighting that. They have to file their signatures by September 23rd or 24th. And, you know, we're working with, you mentioned Free Enterprise Club, with Goldwater Institute. You know, American Federation for Children, we will be very engaged on doing everything we can to get those ESAs going into effect.
Yeah, well, the ESAs are the biggest threat to public education. I mean, in terms of the public sector unions and making sure that parents have choices to send their kids where they
need to go. I think the way you they're the biggest threat to the unions.
Yeah,
they're not the biggest threat to public education. They're actually going to make public
education better. Actually, what I should have said, and I'll correct my assertion, is that the biggest threat to failing schools in public education, to allow parents to make better choices, to send their kids to schools that are performing, whether those are public or private or charter or whatever.
Well, and that's one thing that bothers me about the left is that they like to talk about best interest of children and doing things in the best interest of children, but they don't.
Yeah.
I mean, if they believe that, then, what skin is it off their back if a parent's choosing a private school or a home school or whatever because that's the best setting for their child?
Right. Well, it's power. You can't let...
And money.
Yeah, power and money. Typical teachers union stuff.
It's like David Schweikert always says, follow the money.
Right.
You want to know why something's being done? Follow the money.
Exactly.
It's all about the money.
What gives you the greatest hope as you look at the state, the country, into the future? I mean, you've got kids and grandkids?
No grandkids.
No grandkids yet. Yep. Neither do I. So so I just keep having kids.
I'm glad you said that because I was going to be like, John, are you maybe?
Greatest hope. That's a really good question. I think that people, once you stop and think and see the merits or like the consequences of some of the things that are going on in the culture and how it hurts, every issue that we address at Center for Arizona Policy, there's a human cost. It's real life. It's real world. It's people are being hurt. The 12-year-old that thinks, the little girl who thinks she's going to be a boy, and then she wakes up and she's 25 and she's scarred for life. Because she just went along with the popular notion kind of thing. So I think that even when you look at why do we still have a pro-life movement, it's because we've seen the humanity of the unborn child, but we've also seen how abortion hurts women. That we all know women who've had abortions and who, whether it was physical or emotional, fallout from that. And so I think the hope is that the growing recognition among the population that the leftist agenda, however you want to put it, that it's not an answer. They don't provide solutions. And so we have children who aren't being educated in the public schools. We have, children that are being hurt in different ways. And so I think that gives me hope. And of course, I'm a believer in a holy God and in with Jesus Christ as my Savior. So I hope in Him.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who really break down the culture war into this one last struggle between Marxism, atheism, government-controlled everything, and really Judeo-Christian society.
And there's truth to that.
That's actually the way I see it. I see this breaking down over the next several years into a great conflict between people who believe, as you just articulated, in a holy God and as Jesus as their Savior, who want to live their life in that regard, and those who absolutely reject that and reject Christianity, reject Judeo-Christian values of any sort, and want the government to decide everything.
Well, and then also, we could talk about science a lot, but the social science data still is on our side on these issues. And so even, all these experiments, and that's a lot, giving a 12-year-old puberty blockers is a scientific experiment on that child. And so that's where I think that the social science data still shows. Social science data still shows that the best place for a child is a married mom and dad, and you can't change that kind of thing. And so, even it is a battle.
The social science data specifically on fatherless homes.
Right.
All these mass shootings that happened have a very common denominator. Usually either the father was completely absent, completely incompetent, or not there at all.
Right.
And most of them not there at all. And so they grew up hopeless and not getting the guidance that they need. It's easy to blame the guns and blame everything else. But when you look at the life that young man typically was living, it was one of despair and hopelessness because there was no father in the home, no one to guide them.
Well, I'm glad you have hope because the... Because sometimes I worry, but I have to because I've got two very young kids, three and one, and
Well, I mean, but it's a battle every day. I mean, we're doing some battles in our house right now. I mean, it's 11 and 8, and the culture is coming for them.
Yeah.
And we've had to circle the wagons a little bit, even here recently, but no, the culture is not coming for you. And guess what? We're going to push back on the culture a little bit here.
Yeah. And then you get to where your children are adults, and you both have adult children, too, and you're kind of like, oh my, that's not how we raise them. letting go means letting go.
Letting go.
Yeah, ultimately, as you know, we've talked about before, I mean, God's got this, right? And you have to believe that he's in control. But as long as they're with you, you as a parent have so much truth to speak into your child in ways that you don't even know. You have so much power to push back on both culture and other influences that I don't even think parents understand how much. They may think they're failing, or they may think that it's not making a difference, but it does.
And that's where school choice matters too, because it's, you know, is the school going to, how much is the school or the teacher putting themselves in the place of the parent and the parent losing authority in mm-hmm. their child's life? You know, when you ask, like, the hope, the other thing that I see missing and what parents need and what we see happening is courage. Is that, you know, when we see where the culture is going and the challenges that are out there, are you going to have the courage to speak up? And whether it's within your family, whether it's within the culture, that, you know, we've got some really courageous people that are filing lawsuits to protect religious freedom rights, to protect different rights, and that's what it's going to take, you know, in the political public policy realm, is that are they going to have the courage to speak up, state legislature? I mean, this goes back to running for office. You know, who's going to have the courage to speak up and articulate and fight these issues?
Courage. It's a great theme to end on. Kathy, thank you so much for your courage.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for leading the charge in the cultural wars here in Arizona, and it's setting an example across the country. I mean, I think there's just no question that you've been a template for many other states, which is good. And keep it up.
Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks,
we're guys. We're just blessed to know you, and really appreciate all the great work that you're doing.
Well, so thanks to you too. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, God everybody. Bless. See you.